All right, good morning, everybody. I hope that we can be heard. It's Lynn and Bruce, and we're here to talk about the Journey Home with the book by The Journey Home by Dr. Kenneth Wapnick. And it is about the obstacles to peace. And so we've been reading along every week. Doing pretty well. How are you doing this morning, Bruce?
I'm doing all right.
All right, I'm asking if everybody can hear us okay, if we can be heard all right. Okay, I'm assuming we can. Although, while you're reading, I'm going to go in the other room and check to make sure that the recording is going well.
Okay.
So, I guess, you know, if you want to just go ahead and start reading, or if you want to tell us what's been going on this week with you.
Sure. I have a quick announcement. One is that if anybody hasn't already checked out the new streaming services from Foundation for A Course in Miracles, FACIM.org, highly recommend you go to their new website, which is really less than a year old, and click on streaming, which is a new option, and they've got hundreds of Ken's recordings and ongoing new ones being added by Jeff Siebert and the current staff in Henderson, Nevada. And anyway, just a wonderful depth and breadth of material, both video and audio and podcasts and the weekly programs that they've resumed in Nevada, having moved from Temecula, California last year. And anyway, I just started listening to some of them, and they're really good. There's several, there's over a half dozen free recordings, and all the rest of them are very reasonable, and you can get the streaming audio and video right there. For hundreds and hundreds of Ken's recordings, and the new ones being added as we speak. So, and that's at facim.org.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll type that in the room here. Yeah. And if I don't type it with a, what do you call it? www, it doesn't come up as a link. There we go.
Oh, right.
So there we go, fasm.org. And so, yay, hooray. And I did get a message about that, so I'm grateful for that, and I'll have to check it out and see what's going on.
So if you're on the website, you'll see on the top menu, Home, ACIM, About Us, Announcements, Online Store, Learning Aids, and the new one is Streaming. And then you basically set up a free account, and then you can download and listen to these recordings anytime you like once you've logged in. So.
Wow, that is pretty amazing. Cool. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
Hey. I'll have to do that because I play a lot of Ken. I play Ken Wapnick all the time here. So.
Great.
And I don't, I think it's, a lot of people really appreciate it. I know I do.
Oh. So it's my mainstay, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Yeah. So we were in, I don't know what page we left off on.
32 is what I have us on.
Okay. And so if you want
to back up a little bit.
No. Yeah, we were going to back up.
I think we got to the bottom of 32, but let me back up to where we left off and a little before then. Is that okay?
Yes, yeah. In fact, I think we need to because well, otherwise we'd be starting with something that doesn't have any context. So.
Okay. So I'm going to read one of the bolded quotes. What need is there for seeing then? The only need we have for seeing now is to correct the misperceptions of the ego and to obtain the true perception of the vision of Christ. When that has been totally accomplished and no spots of darkness remain, the whole purpose of this world is finished. The Holy Spirit's true perception has canceled out the ego's false perception, and all that remains is non-dualistic knowledge, as is expressed in this beautiful passage from the Clarification of Terms. And this is from Section 4 in the Clarification. And now God's knowledge, changeless, certain, pure, and wholly understandable, enters its kingdom. Gone is perception, false and true alike. Gone is forgiveness, for its task is done. And gone are bodies in the blazing light upon the altar to the Son of God. God knows it is his own as it is his. And here they join, for here the face of Christ has shown away time's final instant. And now is the less perception of the world without purpose and without a cause. For where God's memory has come at last, there is no journey, no belief in sin, no walls, no bodies, and the grim appeal of guilt and death is there snuffed out forever. And then another quote that Ken has in Boulder. When God has taken the last step himself, the Holy Spirit will gather all the thanks and the gratitude that you have offered him and lay them gently before his Creator in the name of his most holy Son. Again, these are all metaphors. It's not like there's physical things that are placed before someone, some specific person. And of course, Ken immediately reiterates what I just said. Okay. Obviously, this statement is metaphorical, as we have just seen in our mention of the triad of the second coming, last judgment, and God's last step. Moreover, this mention is reminiscent of the passage earlier in the text where Jesus describes how, once the atonement is complete, the Holy Spirit will still remain to bless all of our creations, since what God creates is eternal. And he's referencing chapter 5 in the text. This current passage is another poetic way of expressing the unity of God's eternal love, which is truly ineffable. Do you want to read from there?
Ineffable.
Ineffable, yeah. Hard to be put into words.
I know there's F words, but this is an ineffable.
Right.
Okay. And the Father will accept them in his name. What need is there of seeing in the presence of, flip the page, his gratitude? That's also a quote from the Course. This is a lovely vision of what happens, Ken says, when we finally get past all the obstacles to peace. We return in our awareness to the perfect unity of heaven, where again perception has no purpose and no place. Duality cannot exist in the state of non-duality, which is a very important point. You can only live in one world. You can't live in both worlds. You can only have one or the other, and so we're looking for the perfect unity of heaven. And I'm thinking about today's lesson, which really brings us into that full, no holds barred experience of heaven, because the light has come. And going through everything that we think is happening in the world, we begin to see that everything is forgiven in the forgiven world to a forgiven mind. And everything is light, and you don't have to look at the darkness. You don't have to be afraid of it. You don't have to change it or do anything about it. You just got to be in it. And in that light, you can't be in the dark. So duality cannot exist in the state of non-duality.
That's such an important point in the Course's metaphysics. That really is a pivotal idea, because in perfect oneness, there is no opposite to perfect oneness, and that's the pure non-duality. And I also have to have a tip of the hat to Gary Renard and all the work that he's done over the years, that really, through Art and Persa, his teachers and the writings and work that he's done, there's a lot of emphasis given on pure non-duality as really at the heart and the essence of what the Course is about, because that is, it's simultaneously one of the most challenging ideas, because it also means that our individual selfhood is an illusion, as is perception and even forgiveness, as this last section we just read pointed out. But if there's nothing left to forgive, if there's nothing left to, no separation left to undo in the mind, then that's when we're ready to again, this is sort of almost intellectual at this point, because we're in our typical everyday awareness, we're usually so far removed from anything close to this that it just seems like a nice intellectual curiosity. But that's really our true heritage, is returning home to this state of perfect oneness. And of course, the miracles suggest that we've already accomplished this, but we're dreaming that we're taking this long, drawn-out process that we call, our forgiveness curriculum, to undo the ego and the silly seemingly separate sense of self. as we do that, we come closer and closer to the pure non-duality that the Course really is founded on. And we go through stages of from duality to, you know, non-duality, you know, like semi-non-duality, and then there's you know, sort of partial. I think there's like three or four stages of non-duality that Gary talks about in his books, but it might be useful for people to review if they haven't, or to, you know, look into if they haven't checked into that, because I think it really is a fundamental idea in the course that the perfect oneness has no opposite, but we need the opposites in the world of illusion in order to do the forgiveness work, because that's why Jesus uses so much contrast in A Course in Miracles to show the difference between the illusion of the ego and what our, you know, the reflection of the reality of what we are, that is the peaceful awareness that we all have and are, that eventually takes us home, right?
So, yeah. Absolutely, and so, you know, basically, instead of condemning the world, we can see the light, and instead of being afraid of the dark, we can see the light. And so I'm going to continue to read. Before we proceed to the first obstacle, let me again describe all four obstacles, but in another form. The first three reflect different forms of attack. The first obstacle talks specifically about attack, our desire to get rid of peace by attacking other people. The second obstacle, more specifically, focuses upon our attack upon ourselves. The discussion here focuses on the body and the mind's need for it, seeing it either as an object of pleasure or pain. The third obstacle is the full extension of that attack, which is death. The attraction of death, which is really the attraction of murder, whether we are talking about the murder of someone else or the murder of ourselves. And I think probably everyone who knows me or has heard me over a period of time knows that, you know, I talk a lot about my murderous thoughts. And, you know, I unless you look at them and recognize that I wish I had what you have. I wish I had your house. I wish I had your spouse. I wish I had your car. I wish I had your personality. I wish I had your brains. I wish I had, you know, any time that I'm wishing that I had something that is yours, I'm really wishing that you were dead and I had your stuff. you know, I wish that you didn't have it and I did. And this is why, even when you think that you're admiring someone or thinking that, you know, they're a great person or something, it's still a form of murder, because you are that's not what the person is. It's not who they are. It has nothing to do with their reality. And you are accusing them of being something that they're not. And in accusing your brother of being something that they're not, you're really wishing that they were dead, you know, wishing that they didn't exist. And I know it's hard to imagine that, and I know Ken will talk about that more later, but any type of envy is coveting, envious, is a wish that you didn't have that and I do. You know, it is kind of a strange situation. So, so.
And it's all predicated on the misunderstanding that we've taken as gospel, because of what, you know, the Course calls, well, particularly Ken, in elaborating on lesson 136, one of the phrases in there, that double shield of oblivion. We've made up a world that basically reinforces the idea of duality and separation, in order to escape from the duality in the mind that we also never really happened, but, you know, again, unfounded, but it's unconscious, and that awareness, you know, that there's some fragmentation is, you know, also a myth, but we have to look at it in order to undo it, and in order to see that there is no lack and there is nothing outside of us, including all the things that we think we lack, and, you know, Dash, you're talking about coveting and enviousness and jealousy and all those things that relate to thinking that, you know, some other person is better off than me. Well, the whole other idea of otherness is founded in those two shields. The first other, you know, being the inner shield of of oblivion, which is the idea that separation in the mind is possible, that there could be separate selves or awarenesses or whatever. And then we manifested that because we needed some kind of a more quote-unquote effective scapegoat. We manifested an entire world to reinforce that belief, and we did a bang-up job. But it's all a projection. It's a massive hologram. Behold the great projection.
Yeah. That's right. It is a hoax.
And,
that's
exactly. But we need to look at the hoax, and that's where the persistence and the patience and the gentleness comes in, and why Jesus says, don't fight yourself. Just when you're ready. and here's how you become more ready, by upping the pace and upping the frequency with which you are mindful. But generally, as you become more ready to undo the ego, you'll find that you have the ability to keep the mind more focused on what you really want, which is the peace. And the mechanism for that is by forgiving yourself for believing that it was possible to not be peaceful.
That's it. And like today's lesson, every 15 minutes we're supposed to remind ourselves. And, I know people, someone just on my call just set their watch so that every 15 minutes it will give them an alarm and it will remind them. But, that mindfulness actually comes about after a while. It's like when Jesus says, ask 1,000 times a day who walks with you. Literally, if you did that, you would recognize that Christ walks with you in that there is no separation. But, every 15 minutes or whatever, if we were doing that, it would have an effect, and very, very quickly have an effect. So it's pretty potent stuff. So so the third obstacle is the full extension of that attack, which is death, the attraction of death, which is really the attraction of murder, whether we are talking about the murder of someone else or the murder of ourselves. And, he says, death is a voluntary thing. It is self-murder. So just the idea that we could even actually die is an attack on myself, an attack on God, attack on the world, attack on you. And so recognizing the extent of which our attack takes place is really, really important.
Oh, it is. And the whole idea of that presupposes and assumes correct the crazy notion, according to the Course, that it's even possible for spirit to be crammed down into a body, an infinite, all-inclusive spirit, to be chopped up, put into little pieces, and crammed down into a separate body, which then is fallible, vulnerable, mortal, and corruptible, and subject to decay, rotten death. It's like, if we and of course we all believe that in this world as egos. But there's another thought system that says, maybe that's just one choice. Maybe there's a better way.
There's another way to look at this. Continuing with the reading, therefore Jesus is teaching us here in the first three obstacles to peace about the projections of our guilt and the ego's different ways of expressing its defenses against our ever letting it go. Each layer of defense takes us deeper and deeper into the ego's thought system and leads us to the final obstacle, which is the fear of God. It is this fear, based on the ego's distorted image of our Creator and Source, that causes us continually to project our guilt onto everyone else, to attack other people, and to attack ourselves, therefore making death real. All of these, as we shall see, become the ways of protecting us from what the ego interprets for us as God's wrath. This belief, in turn, is the defense against our ever returning to the decision maker in our minds, which would correct its original error of choosing against the Holy Spirit and believing in the ego's lies of separation and individuality. As presented in these sections in the text, each of the four obstacles comes into two parts. The second section under each obstacle is a commentary on the obstacle, as it has been described in the first. All in all, it is a brilliantly conceived set of sections, and once again a wonderful summary of the thought system of A Course in Miracles.
Okay, so he's just basically prefaced what the rest of the book is going to be about in these last few paragraphs.
Yeah.
And it does take a while to go through them, but because we have such tremendous investment in. Right?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what makes the world go round. The world wouldn't exist if we didn't have these are the things that have created the experience that we have of a world and a body and a life and a death and a sickness and a health, and all these different things are all created from these four obstacles that are the construction materials, basically, of the illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're in part one, the first obstacle, and I'm going to let you speak and read.
Okay. So, yeah, if you're following along in the printed book, we're on page 37, chapter 3 of Ken Wapnick's The Journey Home, The Obstacles to Peace and A Course in Miracles. And the caption underneath chapter 3 in this book, in this chapter, is the first obstacle, the desire to get rid of it. And Ken continues, the first obstacle to peace we must confront on our journey home is the desire to get rid of it. And the it, of course, is peace. So the first obstacle is that we do not want peace. At first blush, this would make no sense. For how many students of A Course in Miracles would say, or even want to say, that they do not want peace? However, as Jesus cautions us in Lesson 185, to say these words, in brackets, I want the peace of God, is nothing. But to mean these words is everything. And I think basically he's saying that, you know, we're all equivocating. We're all vacillating, you know, going back and forth, wishy-washy, whatever adjectives or you know, phrases you want to use to describe that state of being undecided and alternating between two thought systems. And sometimes we do it, you know, multiple times in a second, let alone a minute or an hour or a day, right? But our minds are very powerful, so we can go back and forth. We can have little moments like when we're reading the Course and studying some of Ken's work or things like that, and we kind of get it, and our mind goes in, and a moment later we snap back to thinking about the stuff in the world that we think is so important and starting to fret over what's going to happen or not going to happen in the world. I mean, that's just an indicator that you know, we have more work to do, and to, again, be gentle with ourselves when we discover that, you know, our resistance is still pretty solid.
Yeah, it is. And, you know,
but it does decrease over time. It does diminish as we begin to apply the ideas being presented, and we discover that there is a greater level of peace. But I think we're all pretty clueless as to how profound that peace ultimately is going to be. Because we've been so steeped in the lack of it. And we think these little moments of reflections of peace, we don't really, the ego certainly does not want to give any credence or any credibility to the idea that those are worthwhile, because that really is undoing, and it's the last place the ego wants to go. And so that's where the desire to get rid of the peace that Ken's talking about here is squarely situated, isn't it?
It is. And it's interesting to say these words, I want the peace of God, is nothing, but to mean these words is everything. You know, at the beginning, in the introduction to the workbook, Jesus says, you don't have to really even mean it. You don't even have to know what it means. You don't even have to believe in God. You don't have to do any of these things. Just do these lessons. But then, you know, when you're doing the lesson, what are you doing? What is it that I'm doing if I say, I want the peace of God? And then, you know, the rest of the time I'm like, well, you shouldn't have done that, and these guys are all wrong, and look at this world, and look at this, you know, what about this, and what about that? You know, obviously I am not meaning those words, that I want the peace of God. Obviously, I want the world in all of its chaos. And so, you know, when people say, you know, I did the lesson, 365 days, I did this, I did, you know, if you did this, then you wouldn't be saying that, because you would know. You would have the peace of God. But
there wouldn't be any search, external search of any sort ever.
Right.
Again,
right.
If we truly, you know, completed the curriculum.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. So, saying that you did the lessons and then, you know, copping out by saying, well, yeah, but Jesus says you really don't have to. You know, Jesus says you don't really have to mean this or even know what it means. You don't even have to believe in God. You know, that's, you know, kind of beside the point. You know, it's every day it's a choice. And every day...
Go ahead.
What are you going to say?
I was just going to say, and it's really kind of reflective of the progression in the course between the little willingness that's asked initially and the abundant willingness that's asked toward the end. Because it's sort of like this, you know, if you take a... you know, piece of graph paper, and you've at the origin where, you know, if you draw your X, Y axis, the little zeros point there, and then you draw a little diagonal line going up, from left to right, but going up to where you go from 0 to 100% over time. I mean, this ends obviously, it's not linear because there's all kinds of fluctuation. We go back and forth. But if you were to, like, average out the amount of time that we spend in those two thought systems, I think the course is suggesting that you're going to get more peace, you're going to find more peace in the Holy Spirit's curriculum, and you'll discover eventually that the only time that you really felt any peace was when you were choosing to say no to the ego. And that's really all it is. It's not really having to say yes to, you know, you don't have to, you know, affirm or, you know, it's not like we're making or fabricating or having to create something. It's basically allowing what is our true nature, what's already there, our inheritance, our birthright, to just be in our mind and to undo the blocks, to get rid of it. So that's why I think one of Ken's brilliant commentaries on a course is it's not a course in yes, it's a course in not no. It's a course in looking at our resistance, looking at our desire to get rid of it, and looking at all the myriad ways that we have used to fight against the peace of God because we don't think we're worthy. Because we've equated ourselves with a persona and a body, and it's had this, you know, kind of questionable history. You know, if we kind of look at what we've done in the world, it's like, well, yeah, there've been a few bright spots, but there've been a few, you know, darker periods where, you know, we may have said things or done things that we're not particularly, you know, proud of or you know, you'd want to put on a pedestal. And our news media is filled with things like that. I mean, and we like to parade all the craziness across our computer and phone and tablet and TV screens and everything, all the other forms of media, and because we want some kind of justification for the craziness, and so we can say, oh, see, it's not me, it's everybody else that's messing up the world.
Exactly.
The scapegoat factor. Yeah,
so. The scapegoat factor. And you know, when Jesus in the Bible, I think it was Paul that says all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. You know, it's easy to say, well, yeah, we're all sinners. But, you know, look at that. Really what it's saying is that we've all fallen into the trap of believing that we have fallen short of the glory of God, that we are not reflecting the peace of God, the glory of God, the love of God, the strength of God, the power. We're not reflecting any of that. And so, or we're not reflecting it as we could. But really, honestly, it's a practice. You know, this is why it's a practice. It's not a, you know, it's done. We got to practice it all the time because we practice being bad, being falling short for so long. And so now we are going to practice the peace of God. So to say these words, I want the peace of God, is nothing, but to mean these words is everything.
That's the whole enchilada.
Yeah.
And we're just dabbling with, you know, a few crumbs of ingredients, one or two ingredients at a time, and that's when I'm wondering why it's not quite as tasty.
Tasty, that's right. Okay, so you want to continue reading?
Sure. The problem is we're not aware of how much we do not want to be peaceful, which is why Jesus makes the following statement: trust not your good intentions, they are not enough. Which is basically saying, don't trust the ego's intentions. In other words, we need to actually thoroughly identify with the Holy Spirit at some point before we really are, you know, can kick off the training wheels of trusting what appears to be, you know, something outside or greater than ourselves. But it's really always within ourselves. But we need that symbol of Jesus or the Holy Spirit or inner kindness teacher, whatever, you know, mechanism you use in the mind to represent that peaceful awareness we took with us into the dream that leads us out of craziness. You know, we need to trust that until we're out of the quagmire of ego's nutso-ness.
Nutso-ness, I like
yeah.
that.
And he continues, our unawareness of this ambivalence comes from our not understanding our commitment to and identification with individuality, and therefore not understanding how peace and love are the threats to this individuality. And again, that's actually a fairly advanced idea in the Course, and one that I think, you know, is, again, the tip of the hat to Ken and his brilliance of, you know, sharing how really it's the individuality, the personhood, you know, the non-transpersonal awareness that is really, it's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly, ultimately. Kind of like if you back up off a little squabble that's happening in the room that you're in, and you know, were to take a rocket ship and blast off right from where you were at, and then see, you know, the neighborhood that you're in, and then the little squabble will disappear pretty quickly, and then the state, and then the country, and then the continent, and then the planet, and then, you know, onto galaxy and whatnot. I mean, it really, in even using that physical metaphor, we have to kind of recognize in the cosmic scheme of things all the things that we've made such big deals out of, you know, really truly have had no effect on this infinite eternal spirit that we all are, but that we've disidentified with. And so this is really a process of re-identification to our true, and it's not an individuality, our true self, capital S self, that is beyond the foibles of individuality. So he says, I've already emphasized this fundamental ego dynamic in chapter 1, and we shall return to it again and again throughout this book. Forgetting our rejection of peace is key to the ego's plan of preserving its entire thought system of separation, and therefore the key to our understanding these four principles of peace. So it's the rejection of peace. Okay. Moreover, as we shall see presently, the way we manifest our desire not to be peaceful is to attack others. Well, there's the...
There you go.
There's the poster child, you know, method of staying out of peace, you know, in obstacle one. Do you want to read on?
Sure. Okay. Okay, the first obstacle, and this is from A Course in Miracles, from the obstacles to peace. The first obstacle that peace must flow across is your desire to get rid of it, for it cannot extend unless you keep it. You are the center from which it radiates outward to call the others in. So this is a big deal here. This is not just, you know, I'll be peaceful when you're peaceful. I'll be peaceful when the world is peaceful. I'll be peaceful when, you know, this happens or that. It's saying you'll be peaceful when you're peaceful, and the world will be peaceful through extension. It will be radiated outward from you when you choose peace.
Exactly.
This is really the point of the work that we're doing here is that we become the healers, and I will be healed as I let him teach me to heal. We become healers, and that's today's lesson. It starts out with that very same thing. Let me just take a look at that for a moment really quickly here, because it really does have a tremendous impact on our thoughts, our behavior, what we are. The light has come. You are healed and you can heal. The light has come. You are saved and you can save. You are at peace and you bring peace with you wherever you go. Darkness and turmoil and death have disappeared. The light has come. So this is like the fulfillment of our whole raison d'etre here. Why do we appear to be here? Because we are the light. We are healed. We can heal. We are saved. We can save. We are at peace. We bring peace. The first lesson of the Holy Spirit, to have peace teach, or to have peace, what is it? This is the second lesson, I'm sorry. To have all, give all, the all is the first one. The second lesson is to have peace, teach peace, to learn it. And that's really what, if we want peace, if we want joy, the only way that we can do it is by sharing it with others and sharing it with our brothers. And we choose it. We choose to either keep the peace or give it away, protecting our decision by projecting responsibility for our pain onto others. I didn't start this from the very beginning. This emphasizes the choice that we make. We either choose to keep the peace or we choose to give it away, protecting our decision by projecting responsibility for our pain onto others through attacking them. We can never truly justify our attempts to avoid personal responsibility feeling separated. Jesus makes this quite clear in the following direct statement, which precedes his discussion of the crucifixion at the beginning of chapter 6 in the text. And this is chapter 6 introduction. Anger always involves projection of separation, which must ultimately be accepted as one's own responsibility, rather than being blamed on others. Anger cannot occur unless you believe that you have been attacked, that your attack is justified in return, that you are in no way responsible for it. You cannot be attacked. Attack has no justification, and you are responsible for what you believe. And that's, again, from the introduction to text chapter 6. Okay, so Ken goes on. It is the honesty in recognizing and accepting this attempt to avoid responsibility for our decisions against God that allows us to begin the process that restores to our awareness the mind that has decided this in the first place. Only through this process of honesty and self-examination can we ultimately choose again. This is why Jesus makes this plea to us. And here is a plea. Watch carefully and see what it is that you are really asking for. Be very honest with yourself in this, for we must hide nothing from each other. If you will really try to do this, you have taken the first step toward preparing your mind for the Holy One to enter. And that's text chapter 4, section 3. And then he says, think honestly. I think about this all the time. Think honestly what you have thought that God would not have thought, and what you have not thought that God would have you think. Search sincerely for what you have done and left undone accordingly, and then change your mind to think with God's. And that, again, is in text chapter 4. Early on in text chapter 4, Jesus is telling us we can think with God. We can choose to not think those thoughts that the ego has prepared for us. And by choosing not to, and I love this, think honestly. what you have thought that God would not have thought, and what you have not thought that God would have you think. So I ask myself all the time, you know, of course, and I ask other people too, is that a thought that God would want you to think? Is that a thought that God would think? And you know how easily that clears things up.
Yeah.
It's like taking the light directly to it. Well, you know, if God wouldn't think this, and why would I want God to think that? Oh, my gosh. And why would God want me to think that? Oh, my gosh.
Oh. A real simple criteria for making that distinction is, how does it feel?
Mm-hmm. You know,
if there's peace in the thought, then that would be a thought that God would have you think. Otherwise, not. Another thing that Ken points out is when he says, you know, we must hide nothing from each other. He basically, in one of, I think it's in one of Ken's commentaries somewhere, he says, yeah, and it's not exactly like Jesus is hiding a lot from us. it's all one-sided.
Exactly.
And that just means that, you know, we're not ready at times, or we appear to not be ready, for accepting a greater, more profound peace. And that's okay. And neither should we be upset with someone else, because they're our projection in our classroom, if you will. And that means we need to be, by being patient with others, we're being patient with ourselves, because there is no other. And that's how we heal and are healed, by, you know, providing that, you know, lack of condemnation and that patience and that, you know, the loving kindness that is, you know, very gentle and, you know, realizes that every seemingly other person is, you know, progressing at their own rate toward the homecoming, but we never really left. So the more we can let everybody else off the hook, the more we do that for ourselves.
Absolutely. And so, you know, it's a choice every day, every moment. So he's talking about peace. He says, you are its home. This is from the Course, from the Obstacles to Peace. You are its home, its tranquil dwelling place from which it gently reaches out, but never leaving you. Again, the it's is peace. We are its home in the sense that our minds either welcome it or reject it. Peace thus results from a decision that we make, directly related to our decision whether to remain an individual or to return to our identity, with a capital I, as the non-specific oneness of Christ. The passage also expresses the important principle that what we give, we also receive. The reader may recall our earlier mention of ideas leave not their source, the concept reflected in this statement. Suffice it to state here that as we give peace to other people, it remains with us. This also reflects the process of extension in heaven, which cannot be understood if we think of it from a spatial point of view. God extends his love, yet his love is always retained within himself. And since as his extension, we are his love, we are retained within him as well. That's a real logical and heavy conclusion there.
Sounds like pure non-duality to me.
It's pure non-duality.
Shall I read on?
Sure.
Okay. If you would make it homeless, the peace, how can it abide within the Son of God? If it would spread across the whole creation, it must begin with you. You reach to everyone who calls and bring him rest by joining you. So I guess we could modify that song of "Let there be peace in my mind and let it begin with me." Okay, let us go back to the idea of resting in God within our minds. What this means then is that if we want to obscure the peace that is in us and fight or defend against it, all we have to do is decide not to extend peace. Wow, that's pretty simplified and kind of a eye-opening way of looking at it, isn't it?
It is.
Just by not extending peace, we're saying, "Oh, I choose not to have it myself." Okay. That automatically blocks it, not only from my extending peace to you, but it certainly blocks its extension for myself. The phrase comes to mind is generosity of spirit.
Yes.
I mean, that extension, you know, is really an incredibly grateful and generous giving spirit, because that's what we want to give everyone, because we see the Christ in everyone as ourselves. Right? Okay. This passage also reflects the crucial course theme of the inherent oneness of God's Son. If peace is to embrace the whole creation, W.H. O'Leary, God's one Son, tag we're all it, then it must begin with each of us as seeming individuals, since each of us is God's one Son. This makes no sense to a brain conditioned by the principles of time and space, but the idea of the hologram allows us to begin to appreciate how the whole, W-H-O-L-E, can be found in every part. Again, each individual son contains the whole of Christ. As the workbook emphasizes, one brother is all brothers. Every mind contains all minds, for every mind is one, such is the truth. And then he reads another short excerpt here. Why would you want peace homeless? What do you think that it must dispossess to dwell with you? What seems to be the cost you are so unwilling to pay? And then comments, Ken. Jesus does not answer these questions as they are really rhetorical, but we have already seen the ego's answer. It is our individuality that would be, quote, dispossessed, unquote, if we welcomed peace into our minds. If we really wish the peace of God, we would have to give our guilt away. That means we would lose our individuality, which is protected by the guilt. This is also similar to the discussion in the Laws of Chaos about our desire for the priceless pearl, in quotes, of our brother's specialness that he hid in his body. He references chapter 23, section 2. There it is spoken about in a much more powerful way in terms of the murderous lengths to which we would go to protect our guilt and preserve our specialness and individuality. So I was thinking a moment ago, because we're so invested in time and space, the church lady could have also said, isn't that spatial? Because the space appears to divide and separate people and communities and counties and states and countries and hemispheres and planets, you know. I mean, it's quite an effective illusion, but it has had no effect in truth, because it was causeless. I mean, that the cause of the entire universe, and this is again a pretty profound and staggering idea in A Course in Miracles, that I think we finally, you know, slowly but surely embraces, that the universe, if there is no world, the central thought of course, you know, of course attempts to teach, then the entire thought system of guilt, sin, fear, and duality is unfounded. It's unconscious, but it's unfounded. And when we see that it's unfounded, then we recognize that the whole motivation for making up a universe of form and space and time was causeless. And in truth, because, you know, the guilt and the you know, that whole crazy notion that somehow we divided oneness is not true. But we have to, you know, uncover that lie a little bit at a time, you know, typically it would seem.
Well, yeah, because otherwise you'd go crazy. I mean,
yeah. And to when you feel like things are getting crazy, to recognize, well, because I'm still vacillating between ego and Holy Spirit. I'm going back and forth between those thought systems of sanity and insanity all the time. And until there's a consistency that happens, I'm going to experience, you know, a bit of craziness. And another thing that I think he points out brilliantly is that each system is full-blown 100% all the time. It's not like one gets to be, you know, a little bit less and one a little bit more. No, the thought system of the Holy Spirit is completely sane all the time, 24/7, 365. It's completely insane, 24/7, 365, all the time. And it's just that we, you know, go back and forth between those two with such rapidity and such frequency that you know, it's kind of like watching the frames of a movie, you know, in the projector. The you know, we don't see the flicker, but we go back and forth in our mind really fast at times.
You know what? I do see the flicker. I not all the time, but I have been in states where I've just like seen flickering in and out and in and out and in and out and in and out and recognize. Yes,
yeah.
I'm constantly doing this, and when I really notice it is when I'm meditating or trying to go to sleep at night, and if I'm meditating, this is pretty much a common experience I think with people doing meditation, is that you'll work to get yourself into a state where you are in a concentrating contemplative place, and then without even thinking about it, you're wondering about the next door neighbor's dog, or what you're going to have for supper, or where did this thing go, or what did they say about that? You're just, your mind just boom boom boom, and even when you tell it, wait a minute, stop, I'm here now. You can go back here, you can be here, but recognize that, any moment, at any chance, any time, that the flickering is going to happen, because it is always there. The illusion is always here. It's always in our experience as a body. You can't not experience the illusion as a body, because it just as you can't experience your true holiness as a body. As long as you're experiencing being, thinking that your body or being in a body or however you want to say it, it's going to be drawing your attention. And so, you do flicker in and out. If you can concentrate, you can contemplate, you can every 15 minutes, think, the light has come, but then the other 14 minutes and 59 seconds, you're going to be thinking about all kinds of other stuff. And even if you do flicker into, thinking the light has come, if you do flicker into a consciousness and a wholeness with all that is, which is really what it is. It's a consciousness and wholeness of all that is, without all the little separate flickerings, without the darkness being, without the shadows being presented. In the light is all light, but in my mind, in the world, in my body, in the way that I am, I'm going to constantly be flickering in and out, and sometimes more or less, depending on how much distraction or how easily I'm distracted or how I want to be distracted or what I would prefer to be doing, or it's all a fight against ourselves. It's all completely conflict against ourselves. And so understanding how I fight this is really essential to recognizing when I am fighting it, and which is most of the time, in my experience.
Yeah, and I think just being mindful and gentle with yourself when you catch yourself, being not peaceful, and recognizing that as a conscious choice, that really begins to weaken and lessen the white knuckle grip of the ego in our mind, and we say, wow, I was not peaceful for this whole stretch of time because I wanted to figure it out on my own. I wanted to not get help and not extend the help, and it's a two-way street. If we are helpful, we are helped, and the seeming others are benefiting in ways we can't even imagine because all minds are joined. But to the degree that we shut ourselves down and put a tourniquet on that piece, whatever metaphor you like, constrict, reduce the flow, not accept the truth, to that same degree, you know, we're not going to be peaceful, and we just need to just watch and say, wow, that didn't work for me. You know, how's that working out for you? Well, when we're not we're not choosing that awareness of peace by looking at our blocks to it, you know, we're not going to be peaceful. So it's really just being willing to look without condemnation and say, oh, that just, you know, I don't have to make a big deal. This is just, that just wasn't working. And be real gentle with ourselves.
Yeah, and be real gentle with ourselves is right. Okay, so where are we at here?
I've got us the top of page 40, which is where the little barrier of sand.
All right. I need to turn the page then. Wait. No, we didn't go that far. Where am I? Okay, you are at home. Again, the it's is peace. The passage also expresses the important principle that what we give, we receive. That's, I think, the last thing I read.
Okay.
Okay, so...
Did I flip too far, maybe?
I think you maybe did. Cause, then we're talking about if you would make it homeless, how can it abide within the Son of God? If it would spread across the whole creation, it must begin with you, and from you reach to everyone who calls and bring him rest by joining you. And I think that was the last thing that we read. So do you want to read, or do you want me
to read? Sure. Okay. Let's go back to the idea of resting in God within our minds. What this means that is, if we want to obscure the peace that is in us and fight or defend against it, all we have to do is decide not to extend peace. That automatically blocks it, not only from extending peace to you, but it certainly blocks its extension for myself. This passage also reflects the crucial core theme of the inherent oneness of God's Son. If peace is to embrace the whole creation, God's one Son, then it must begin with each of us as seeming individuals, since each of us is God's one Son. I think we did read this, but that's right. This makes no sense to a brain conditioned by the principles of time and space, but the idea of the hologram allows us to begin to appreciate how the whole can be found in every part. Again, each individual Son contains the whole of Christ. As the workbook emphasizes, one brother is all brothers. Every mind contains all minds, for every mind is one, such is the truth.
Wow. Okay, well, I will read. Yeah, you did read this, but I'm going to read. Go ahead and continue reading here. Then, why would you want peace homeless? What do you think that it must dispossess to dwell with you? What seems to be the cost that you are so unwilling to pay? And that's Jesus asking this from the obstacles to peace. What is it? Jesus does not answer these questions as they are really rhetorical, but we have already seen the ego's answer. Now I see the little barrier of sand. I couldn't find where that was. It is our individuality that would be dispossessed if we welcome peace into our minds. If we really wish the peace of God, we would have to give our guilt away. This means that we would lose our individuality, which is protected by the guilt. This is also similar to the discussion in the Laws of Chaos about our desire for the quote-unquote priceless pearl of our brother's specialness that he hid in his body. There it is spoken about in much more powerful way in terms of the murderous lengths to which we would go to protect our guilt and preserve our specialness and individuality. And, yeah, that's what I was going to say. That's where I realized how murderous I really am. This was from reading that in the Laws of Chaos and recognizing, oh, my God.
And when you see how crazy, insane, and whacked out and you know, zombified the ego is, you know, the first approach is usually to recoil and terror, but we just kind of have to look at it and say, wow, yeah, that's really a frightened child. That's really, in truth, a call for love, masquerading as this hideous, monstrous thought system.
Exactly.
That appears to be, you know, out to murder and destroy everything that is not itself in the cosmos, you know, and until everything is total entropy.
Exactly.
But anyway, that we could go on. I think we should stop there and pick up where we left off. Again, as a reminder, for people who haven't checked out the new streaming service at facim.org, check out the streaming option there and set up a free account and enjoy Ken's audios and videos and Jeff's new stuff too. So.
Thank you so much, Bruce Rawls. And
likewise, man.
Cindy Trope says, innocent. Yes, we are innocent. Mm-hmm. We are born innocent. Yes, So anyway, thank you so much, Bruce Rawls, and thanks for joining me on this beautiful Saturday morning. And I'm going to turn the mic now over to you, Iris and Carrie. The mic is all yours.
Well, thank you, Lynn. Very nice. I was just chatting back and forth with Iris, just reading Eckhart Tolle, listening to The Power of Now. I read that book. That was like the first book after I found the course. I read the course for several years, and then I my neighbor gave it to me for Christmas. She gave me that one in his other book, The New Earth. And I read The Power of Now, and as I was reading it, it just dawned on me the way he talked about it and taught about it. It dawned on me just how much the ego was still hiding in me, you know. I was